I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Craig Pittman is a writer and reporter who's been covering environmental stories with the Tampa Bay Times for 15 years. His most recent book is called The Scent of Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. It's a true crime story about a Peruvian orchid smuggled into Florida. I'll talk to Craig about his book, Florida Environmental Politics, and more. That's ahead on Intersection. Now, people may be familiar with the book The Orchid Thief, which is Susan Orlean's account of rare orchid poaching in South Florida. And that book was made into a Hollywood movie adaptation starring Nicolas Cage. But it's not the only real-life story from Florida where orchid enthusiasts have ended up on the wrong side of the law. I'm joined in the studio by Craig Pittman. Craig is a native Floridian. He's covered environmental stories for the Tampa Bay Times since 1998. He's written three books, and his most recent work is The Scent of Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. Craig, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Craig, this book is listed under true crime slash gardening, and that's probably not a combination you see very often.
It does tend to confuse the bookstore clerks, yes.
Indeed. What's the response to the book been so far?
Oh, it's been incredible. People who are interested in orchids tell me that they love it. They say it's the most accurate book on orchid collecting that they've ever seen. And on the other hand, I have people coming up and saying, I have no interest in orchids whatsoever, but this book is just so exciting. It's like reading a paperback thriller, except everything's true.
Right. And so the story centers around the Marie Selby Botanical Gardens in Sarasota. Now, you were covering the story of this orchid, the Phragmopedium kvackii, in 2002 for what was then the St. Petersburg Times. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I covered it. There were some hearings going on in court, and that's how I kind of got started on this.
And just sort of briefly, this orchid discovered in Peru brought into the country, into the United States by Michael Kovac, I guess we can call him a flower collector and an orchid enthusiast. It turns out that he didn't have the correct permits to take the orchid out of Peru and bring it into the U.S., but it seems like from your story that he really wanted an orchid named after him. And it also seems from your book that the staff at Selby kind of wanted the glory of being the first to name this orchid too. And you write that they were so enthralled by this flower's beauty that they failed to anticipate the legal consequences of their actions. Now, just pick it up for us and tell us what happened after Mr. Kovac brought this orchid into the States and had it named.
Well, I mean, I think the thing to remember is that this book isn't just about orchids. It's about human nature and about that human desire to make the big score, to score the winning touchdown or the winning home run. And that's what everybody involved in this discovery, this orchid, thought of it. They wanted this thing to be this wonderful, magical object that would transform their lives. Kovac found this orchid in Peru and brought it back to the United States in a suitcase full of dirty underwear and, just kind of swooped through the Miami airport and drove it to Sarasota with the goal of having it named after him so he'd have this sort of botanical immortality. The folks at Selby Gardens, they were looking for a big score that would make their names in the orchid world again and make people pay attention to them again. And so they gladly agreed to name the orchid after Kovac and to in order for them to have the glory of being the ones to publish the official description of it. And nobody involved in it anticipated that what would happen next would be that the governor of Peru would file a formal complaint with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and say, we would like our orchid back, please. And there soon followed grand jury investigation, subpoenas galore, scientists turning on each other and agreeing to testify for the prosecution. And then things got really weird.
So what's happened to Mr. Kovac now? Has he gotten the immortality that he was looking for?
Well, the plant does still bear his name, although that's a very controversial subject with a lot of folks. He does still have that measure of immortality. On the other hand, he's out of the orchid business. So as a result of some of the things that happened that I tell about in the book.
Why is it such a big deal to find and name these new varieties of flower? Because it seems like from your book that there is a real culture around orchids and it's quite unique to the flower and unique, I suppose, even in the world of people who are interested in botanicals.
Well, yeah, I joke in the book that the folks who are fans of orchids are the ones who put the cult in horticulture.
Right.
But they are, you know, I have to say, everybody involved in the orchid world talked to me for this thing. Even the one guy who went to prison talked to me. And they're very bright, articulate folks who have very strong opinions about everything. And they are just absolutely fascinated, intoxicated even by these beautiful plants. I mean, there are more orchid species than there are any other plant species in the world, about 30,000 of them. So you can kind of see why you would never grow bored with the subject. Plus, consider all the hybrids that you can make out of them. And, you know, over the centuries, fans of orchids have included Confucius and Charles Darwin. You know, it's obvious that they appeal to a sort of an intellectual sort of person as well. So that's part of it too. But these folks, I mean, bear in mind that this particular orchid, before Kovac brought it back from Peru, was selling on the black market for $10,000 a plant. That should give you an idea of just how special this particular one was and the lengths to which some people would go in order to get it.
And you talked too about Miami and saying that it's not just an entry point for contraband, like, you know, we might associate as a sort of a nexus of drugs coming into the country, but you say wildlife's also pretty high on the list, the third most popular entry point for smuggled wildlife, according to federal inspectors. And you list things like monkey skulls, snakes, finches taped inside hair rollers in one case. Why is it that Miami is a point where people will go if they want to bring things into the US?
Well, part of it's just the location. You know, it's a central nexus for people traveling from Central and South America. And there's an awful lot of wildlife down there that people in the United States would pay a lot of money to get. But the other reason, too, is simply because the inspectors there are understaffed and underfunded. And one of the people that I quoted in the book, an agent named Jorge Picon, he was the last Fish and Wildlife Service agent there who spoke Spanish. So, you know, and then he retired. So, I mean, that's been a problem for them as well. They do their best. They certainly do their best. One of the stories I told in the book, and I don't guess it gives too much away to tell to repeat this, is how they set up a sting one time for a gentleman from Mexico who had flown up trying to buy a monk, a gorilla, on the black market. And so, in order to make the exchange work, they actually dressed one of the agents up in a gorilla suit and put him in a cage with some rather convincing smelling material from the Miami Metro Zoo, and managed to work the deal and make the bust. And once it was over, the agent was, you know, of course, sweating to death inside this suit in Miami, and you know, and so he opened the cage to come out, and the suspect still thought it was a real gorilla and tried to jump out of the airplane they were in.
And do you get the sense, too, from your reporting, and I suppose since you wrote the book, that there is still a thriving trade in rare flowers, a legal trade, a black market trade in rare flowers and other kinds of horticultural items coming through Florida?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, definitely, definitely there is. And you know, I've heard a number of stories since the book came out about things that happen. One that I like to tell people when I'm going around presenting about the book is, a friend of mine who is very, very involved in orchids and has written books about orchids went to a show not too long ago where there was a Phragmopedium cavaquii that was on display in bloom, and it was the first one he'd ever seen in person. And he said, "You know, Craig, my God, it was just as magnificent as you described it. I just couldn't stop staring at it." Eventually, he tore himself away and went and saw everything else at the orchid show, but he thought, "You know, I'll go back and see it one more time because I can't leave without drinking this thing in one more time." And he went back. And someone had snatched the blossom off the stalk.
This happened at a flower show?
Yes. Apparently they wanted the pollen.
My goodness. So do they, I mean, do they not have security and the like? I mean, if it seems if you've got a $10,000 flower there, you'd want to have some security of some sort.
They probably will now.
Now, some of the people who appear in your book, it seems that they are of the opinion that the laws aren't really sensible. They sort of see themselves, you know, from my reading of the book anyway, as you know, spreading these orchids around, and they see it as a good thing. And they see some of these
Yes.
kind of conservation laws as just a, you know, needless hindrance to getting these orchids out so people can appreciate them. Is there a real kind of disconnect between the needs of conservation and the desire of orchid enthusiasts to get these plants out and about?
Well, the argument that they make was that, hey, if we leave it there, somebody's going to destroy it. If we take it out, then it can be seen and studied by people who actually appreciate it. And there is a valid argument to be made that the laws that protect these orchids and other endangered species, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES as it's called, is designed to regulate trade only. It does nothing for saving habitat. So, for instance, when Peru builds a new road through the Andes Mountains, it could wipe out 1,000 acres of orchids, and there's nothing that the law can do anything about it. But say someone goes in there and takes one of those orchids and puts it in a suitcase and smuggles it out of Peru, they've saved the orchid, they've brought it out to a wider audience, but they've violated the law. Of course, they probably are doing it for a great profit as well. So they're not, their hands are not exactly clean philosophically on that or morally on that. But the argument is, and it's a fair argument, that the law doesn't really target what the biggest threat is, and the biggest threat is actually the loss of habitat.
Do you think there is something which the United States could be doing to try and get, safeguard some of these flowers or the flowers' habitat? If you're talking about habitat in a completely different country, what could the US do to make sure that I suppose that the trade in orchids doesn't somehow facilitate, the loss of a species or some kind of environmental degradation?
Well, the one sort of hopeful note, I guess you would say, in the book comes from a guy named Alfredo Manrique, who's a Peruvian orchid grower who, unlike everybody else, was not out to make a quick buck, and instead was very diligent about working with the Peruvian government and getting permission to go out into the wild and collect exactly five plants, five Phragmopedium cavaquii, and bring them back and then try to clone them and produce them in a laboratory as a way to circumvent that whole, hey, let's go out in the wild and strip the entire jungle of every flower we can find. And I think there's a lot the United States can do to encourage that kind of approach to endangered species whenever they're discovered in other countries, as far as, making it clear these are the kind of imports we would allow. These are the kind of things that we would allow into our country where we have people willing to pay top dollar for them.
And finally, just on this story, what's the effect been on Selby Gardens? Because really, a lot of the folks involved in that botanical gardens went through the wringer over the
They
story.
did. They really did.
Has it recovered? I mean, is it back to what it was before this
No.
drama?
No. They recently hired their first new orchid person in a long, long time. For quite a while, they had nobody there working on orchids, which was very sad because that was the whole reason why Selby was created in the first place. And I think that financially, they're still kind of reeling from what happened as well. And we'll see what happens. The current manager there asked for a copy, an advance copy of the book, and read it. I have not gotten any reaction from him about what he thought about it. But I think it's folks who have worked there tell me it's a very, very, very fair depiction of what went on, not just with the Phragmopedium cavaquii, but in general with what happened there.
I'm speaking with Craig Pittman, Tampa Bay Times staff writer and author of The Scent of Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. You can join the conversation online on our Facebook page or Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Craig, I want to talk to you now about environmental issues in Florida. Now, Florida lawmakers recently approved an extra $10 million in the state budget for restoration, protection, and preservation of Florida's springs. But does the Department of Environmental Protection have a good plan for how to use this money?
They told me they did not at that point, that this was not money that they had expected to get. They have a whole laundry list of ideas from the various water management districts that totals about $122 million. Obviously, $10 million is not going to make a big dent in all of those needs that have been foreseen. But they said that they needed to meet with the people who sponsored that in the legislature and with the governor's office and get some direction from them about how to spend that $10 million. There's obviously a lot of needs there. Whether it gets sent to the places it needs to go remains to be seen.
What's your assessment of how the Department of Environmental Protection is doing in terms of protecting those natural assets like springs? Because they have come in for some pretty stern criticism from environmentalists, particularly under the administration of Rick Scott.
Let me back up. Under Governor Jeb Bush, there was a real strong effort made to figure out what was wrong with Florida Springs, because they're not just an environmental treasure, but they're also an economic driver for a lot of areas in North Florida. And the fact that they were all suffering from pollution, from toxic algae blooms, and from a loss of flow really alarmed a lot of people, 12 years ago. So under Governor Bush, they launched this big initiative. A task force of experts put together a report of everything that needed to be done. They set up individual working groups for some of the major springs. And then when Governor Scott came in, they ended those working groups And meanwhile, the one recommendation out of the Springs report that got enacted by the legislature was the thing for requiring septic tank inspections, which was sort of a minor aspect of the report anyway. And it caused such a furor among people who had septic tanks that the legislature then turned around and repealed it. So it's, you know, I can understand why people who are advocates for Springs might feel very frustrated by that. On a broader look at how the DEP is doing, I've done a number of stories where people who had worked at the department have been let go or have been fired and said, hey, this is where this is how things are going in there. One guy who was the Tampa district director for DEP said he had been put in place with orders to make the department more friendly to business, to calm down all the people who are upset about being regulated. And basically, the top priority was business over environment. And that seems to be the general criticism of the way things have gone with the DEP. Having said that, they did initiate a program early on where they were going to open up a lot of the state parks to more camping and more, including bringing in people with RVs, and that ran into a huge wall of protests. There was one public hearing I covered here that drew 1,000 people, and not a single one of them was in favor of the proposal, and Governor Scott killed it. He said, you know, if people are that adamant about protecting their state park, then we're not going to do that. So they are responsive to the will of the people.
Right. What about the argument, though, as you mentioned just now, that you know, environmentalists say that the water management boards, for example, they've been sort of stripped of some of their scientific know-how. I mean, some of those boards, and we just had the chair of the South Florida Water Management District in here for an interview recently, saying that it's really just an economic decision. Everybody's kind of going through these tough times, and they have to figure out ways to save money, and that's one of the ways they're doing it. But environmentalists oftentimes just don't see it that way. They see there's more of an agenda there. Do you think there is good evidence for that?
One thing is true, and that is that the governor and legislature forced all of the water management districts to cut back on the amount of money that they were raising through taxes, and they cut their budgets, just slashed them, and that forced them to lay off a large number of people. And obviously, whenever you're looking at layoffs, some of the people you look at are the ones who have been there the longest because they're making the most money. That means that those water management districts laid off an awful lot of people who had an awful lot of expertise, including some who were running the whole Everglades restoration program. That was kind of a big shock, I think, for a lot of environmental advocates, was the loss of this long knowledge of how the Everglades works and what the goals were for restoration and that kind of thing. And some of those folks, too, had been openly critical of the direction that things have been going. And so that, you know, raised the questions about whether there was some targeted aspect of this.
And, I mean, the DEP, they haven't been shy about coming back and basically sort of disputing some of the stories you've written, right? They put out some press releases.
Yes, they put out the press releases called Setting the Record Straight, and
right.
we sort of joke internally as to which one of us has gotten the most of them. So,
right. Do you think it would be better for them to be just sort of sticking to the knitting and putting more effort into the science behind the decisions they're making rather than defending those decisions from a political standpoint?
Well, here's the thing that bothers me, I guess is the right word, and that is that in a number of those cases and where they put out the Setting the Record Straight press releases, they did so after I had spent months and months trying to get their side of the story, and specifically trying to get an interview with the DEP Secretary, Herschel Vineyard.
What do you think of the governor's budget this year in terms of what it does for the environment? I mean, if you step outside of looking at things from an environmental perspective for a moment and think about what happened with education. A lot of money came out of education the first couple of years. Scott sort of had a bit of a revelation, I suppose you could call it, and put money back into that. Do you think the same thing is happening with regards to the environment, or is there still time for Governor Scott to make a turnabout and start putting more resources back into Florida's environment?
Well, there's a joke among environmental reporters that you can tell who's running for re-election by how often they mention the word Everglades. The Everglades is getting $880 million in this budget, and that's considered a huge victory, even though it's less than what the EPA had originally wanted the state to spend on Everglades cleanup. On the other hand, the money that's being put forward for restarting the very, very politically popular Florida Forever land buying program is predicated on the idea that they can turn around and sell off a sufficient amount of property that they've already bought in order to finance it. And I have yet to see a list of property that shows that they have $50 million worth of land that they can successfully sell off. So some of it you have to wonder how much of it is sincere, but I know the environmental advocates that I talk to are happy just to get even a penny or two out of the budget after the previous couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, too, about another story you published this year talking about people who deserve to be great Floridians. And Governor Rick Scott named golfer Jerry Lester Bubba Watson Jr.
Yes.
And a bunch of other people, including Tim Tebow, to the state's official list of great Floridians. Of course, if you talk to anybody from Gainesville, they'd be totally on board with that.
And I wasn't criticizing his choice of Tim Tebow. It's just
sure.
that Bubba Watson, I thought, well, okay, he won one Masters tournament. What else has he done? And what's he done that makes him a great Floridian? So I thought, okay, who are some other people who might be more qualified to be called a great Floridian than Bubba Watson, who may be the nicest guy in the world? I just thought, surely there are people who are more qualified.
And you talk about Clyde Butcher. That's one of the people you mentioned, and he's a fairly well-known landscape photographer. You sort of put him
yes.
in the same category as Ansel Adams. So
sure.
it's sort of, his time is due to be on that list, you think?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, he has certainly helped educate a vast majority of Florida's public about what wilderness still looks like in Florida. I interviewed him years ago before he became famous, and he said that he was at the time still taking his photos around to the little, community art shows all over the place. And he said he inevitably would get people come up and say, where was this? You'd have a picture there of the Everglades or someplace like that, a Hillsborough River, and they'd say, where did you take this? Is this in Africa? Is this in South America somewhere, some deep jungle? And he'd say, no, this was in Florida. And they're like, no, I've been to Disney World. That's not what it looks like. So he's not just a great artist. He's also someone who's educating us on what our state looks like.
I want to ask you, too, about another book, and this is also somebody we had on the program not too long ago, T.D. Allman. he's not shy of a fight, that's for sure. He's a fairly feisty writer, as you know, and he wrote a book, Finding Florida, The True Story of the Sunshine State. Now, you went through the book with a fine-tooth comb, and you found a few things you thought were wrong with it. Just kind of sketch out for us.
That's the thing. It didn't take a fine-tooth comb. A colleague of mine, Jeff Klinkenberg, and I were comparing notes. We'd both picked up the book and we're going through it, and we're both just shaking our heads at just every page. It seemed we found something on it that was wrong. He said that palm trees are not native to Florida. That's not true. He said that he gave this whole story about Marjorie Kenton Rawlings and why she came to Florida. He got all of the facts wrong in that story. His story about there being no statue to the guy who actually founded St. Augustine, not true. There's a statue there. And so many of the things he got wrong tends to undercut the story that he's telling. And it was a real disappointment, a real letdown. And we just thought it would be fun to write a little story giving our top 10 picks of the things he got wrong. I mean, one of the things he said was there has never been any serious science done in Florida, which we thought, well, gee, that's going to come as a shock to all the marine biologists and archaeologists and everyone else who's been working here, not to mention the people at the National Magnetics Lab in Tallahassee.
Sure.
So we did that, and there are fans of T.D. Allman who took exception to that. One of them has a letter to the editor in our paper today accusing the Times of actually having a vendetta towards T.D. Allman, which is not true. Now, having said that, can I recommend a different book? Gilbert King's book, Devil in the Grove, which is a terrific book about Florida history, about a very dark chapter in Florida history, which won the Pulitzer Prize this year, rightfully so, is just a marvelous work about Florida and about Florida's racial history, and contains some stories you won't find in Finding Florida. I think the difference, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think the difference is Gilbert King actually went and found the original documents. He had access to FBI documents about the case that had never been seen before, access to legal defense fund documents used by Thurgood Marshall in the case that nobody else had seen before. And so he had all these original sources where I believe Mr. Allman has been telling people, oh, I didn't do any original research, I used all secondary sources. And I think that may be, maybe that's where some of the errors crept in.
As somebody who you've spent a lot of time covering environmental stories in Florida, do you sort of feel reasonably positive that some of the Florida landscape and the wilderness that you get out and cover in your stories is still going to be around sort of 10, 20 years from now?
I think so. And I think the reason is because people, unlike they did in the 60s and 70s, people really treasure that now. I mean, I mentioned before about the public hearing that drew 1,000 people. Those were people who cared very passionately about Honeymoon Island near Dunedin, and they wanted to keep it pristine and keep it the way it was and not have these big polluting RVs pulling in there day and night for people who would camp but not actually be part of the state park. And I did a story a few years ago where a couple of legislators thought it would be a really neat idea if they would let Jack Nicklaus come in and design golf courses in some of the state parks, that would draw more people to those state parks, and gee, wouldn't that be nifty? And folks went nuts, and they just bombarded those legislators with calls and letters and emails saying, "How dare you touch our state parks like this? How dare you try and build golf courses in there?" And they withdrew the legislation before it even came up for a vote. So people grasp that the environment is the economy in Florida. That's a large reason why a lot of people come here. They come here for the beautiful breezes and the beautiful sunsets and, to go to the beach and to swim and to enjoy our state parks, to enjoy kayaking the rivers or canoeing the rivers, bicycling the various trails or hiking. And they realize that it's not just because it's pretty, but also because it makes money for us, and that therefore it's got a couple of reasons to preserve it. And I think those folks will fight tooth and nail to preserve the things that they think are worth preserving.
Do you think, though, people are willing to spend money to keep those environments in the pristine state that they are in, or even if they're not pristine, relatively unspoiled?
I think that you're going to see people, as you have in the past, you'll see people trying to figure out where's the balance that we can strike. I mean, this is sort of the, I always call this the perpetual Florida conversation. I grew up in a household where my dad's a land surveyor, so he was working for people who are out, building all the new subdivisions and so forth. My mother, an avid backyard bird watcher, and who never missed, the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, National Geographic specials on TV. And to me, they were sort of the genesis of this idea of there's this perpetual Florida conversation of what can we do to save the things that are special about Florida and yet at the same time provide jobs and homes for the people who want to come here and work here. And how do we balance that? And the balance is an ever-shifting ideal that we all fight over. Nobody's ever completely happy with the results, and somehow we work to make that balance work. And with the idea, and I've heard Bob Graham invoke this phrase a number of times, the idea that we don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. We don't want to alter the environment to the point where it drives people away. We don't want to mess up a good thing, basically. We don't want to, paint a mustache on the Mona Lisa, which is what we've got. We've got the Mona Lisa here. We have to protect it. And if we want to have people continuing to come here and continuing to enjoy Florida the way it is, I mean, we're not just the wacky state, we're also the land of flowers.
Well, I've been speaking to Craig Pittman. Craig is a native Floridian. He's an environmental reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. He's written three books, the most recent of which is The Scent of Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and The World's Most Beautiful Orchid. Craig, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection, there you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. I'm